يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Hello and welcome to another Middle East Analysis with myself, James Abbott, from the Catholic Communications Network, and Dr. Harry Hagopian, who's usually in the chair, thank goodness. Harry is an international lawyer, consultant to the Bishops of England and Wales on the Middle East, and was formerly an Assistant General Secretary of the Middle East Council of Churches. Harry, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, James. It's nice seeing you, and I hope you enjoyed your holidays.
It was a nice little break, but my goodness, there wasn't really a holiday in the MENA region. And we're going to cover the bases here, starting with Syria, Harry. Now, some of the things I've seen on TV across a number of networks, we've acknowledged that obviously things are hard to verify and there are no international journalists to corroborate much of what we see there. But, you know, rivers running red with blood. We see shellings of UN refugee camps for Palestinians. What on earth is going on at this stage?
I think it's gone crazy in Syria, and it's really mind-numbing in a sense, the scenes that we've all seen on our television screens, the reports I get from people both within the country and outside the country, whether from the coordinating committees who are trying to follow what's happening in the country, the Human Rights Observatory, which is a London-based organization following up events in Syria as well. And basically what has been happening is that the military has decided to use its full force in different towns and cities in the country, the main key ones that it considers as troublesome or problematic. So it has sent its tanks into Homs, into Hama, into Deir ez-Zor in East Syria. And now the latest has been the coastal Mediterranean town of Latakia or Latakia. And basically the idea behind it, I suppose, is that they think that by sheer force they can crush the popular revolts and re-establish their rule in the country, which I think is a very questionable issue.
Well, you said troublesome. A refugee camp isn't troublesome. Why on earth target a camp like that?
Well, the refugee camp, which is this one, is the Ramil refugee camp, which houses about 10,000 Palestinians in Latakia. It's one of many camps in the country. Those are Palestinian refugees who fled to Syria in 1948 and ever since. And basically what the regime is doing is it's basically following a course of punitive action. The Palestinians have not sided with the regime, have not voiced their support to the regime, although they have been careful enough not to oppose the regime either, because they find themselves in a very difficult situation in Syria where they're almost in camps. And what can you really say? Hamas, for instance, which has a presence in Syria, has been oddly silent about all the atrocities that are taking place. So I think it's as much punitive as it is random, in the sense of proving to the Syrian people and all those who are going out onto the streets every evening after the Ramadan prayers, what are known as the Taraweeh prayers, coming out in the streets and demonstrating against the regime and shouting slogans about the overthrow of President Assad and his clan, they're basically being told, if you continue this, we're going to kill you all.
Now, I should say at this point that we are competing ever so slightly with a drill from next door, where they're building a lovely boutique hotel. You know, that's what they're doing in London right now. So just to move on slightly, though, Harry, you know, Al-Assad, in terms of international diplomacy, we've heard a lot of noises from Turkey, but he's kind of just hanging in there, really. People are very reticent, particularly with what's going on in Libya. They're very reticent to be too firm still, aren't they?
They are very reticent. The West doesn't really have much of an appetite to become involved in Syria the way it became involved willy-nilly in Libya. So in a sense, it's being very, very careful. The Arab countries, the same. Turkey has basically, in some sense, been speaking from both sides of its mouth. On the one hand, it promises that it will take stern measures and action against the Assad regime if it continues to kill civilians. On the other hand, it keeps on giving it more time in order to implement those reforms that have been promised since months ago. But in a sense, I think that there has been a slight qualitative change since we last spoke, James, because on the one hand, the Arab League has said something, at least it has woken from its slumber. Some Arab countries, including the most important, in my opinion, Saudi Arabia, have recalled their ambassadors from Syria as a form of protest, including also Bahrain, Kuwait, and lately Tunisia. The Egyptian government has also expressed its concern about what's happening. The sad thing is that we're still talking about concern when there are so many people who are being killed, there's so many people who are being arrested, wounded, detained. I mean, the country is in an absolute mess. But the West today, for instance, the United Nations holds its own closed session to discuss the situation with Syria again. And on Monday, the UN Human Rights Commission would meet up. So I think that if between now and Monday, they do decide to speak out more openly about the situation in Syria, if they are to qualify what the regime is doing against its own citizens as crimes against humanity, then, or war crimes, then that would lead us to a situation where we might then see the International Criminal Court kicking in again. And that in itself would be a very, very strong deterrent for what's happening. But there are other sanctions that could be taken. For instance, the freeze on bank assets is one of them. We've already done this in the West, but it has to be done perhaps more proactively. Then in Deir ez-Zor, in the east of the country, you've got oil and gas. You've got the cotton industry that Syria is famous for. There are ways to implement sanctions that would hurt economically and therefore hurt the regime, weaken it more, and manage to force it toward change of one sort or another. Those are some of the things that need to be done externally. And internally, of course, the opposition, which unlike Libya, which has its own transitional national council, does not really have a cohesive, coherent voice with which to articulate its demands. And I think President Assad and the regime are making use of that lack of cohesion.
Do you know, I was watching Russian news television just because I was thinking about how diplomatically how this is playing out across the world. And, you know, there's a lot of talk of not necessarily support for the regime, but it was looking at that side of things, despite, you know, even in the face of these atrocities. And it got me thinking a bit and looking at the Christian presence in Syria. You know, there are clearly Ba'athist, you know, the ruling party sympathies there because they're left alone to live in freedom and worship in freedom to an extent. So, you know, it's a bit of a conundrum, isn't it, for the Christians in Syria as to who they should be supporting. Yet as Christians, with believing what we believe in, you can't stand and watch that sort of thing happening, can you?
It's a conundrum that is faced by many Christian communities across Syria, and it's a conundrum that I face daily in my writings, in my interviews, etc. You're absolutely spot on, James. It is a problem. First of all, let me just say that one of the problems that is hampering any concerted action or sanctions against Syria for what it is doing against its own citizens is the fact that Russia primarily, but also countries like China and to a lesser extent India, Brazil and South Africa are dragging their feet in terms of supporting any robust action to stop this mayhem that is being created and those promises that are being given every day only to be broken the next day. So in that sense, let's keep that also in mind as to why the situation is as bad as it is at the moment. In terms of the Christian communities, you're absolutely right. You and I have spoken many times before, way before the ferocity of the MENA revolts became clear to us, particularly in Syria, where I used to tell you, if you remember, that two countries where I thought Christian communities were pretty much living a relatively peaceful situation, apart from Lebanon, which is a special case, were Syria and Jordan. Yeah. Now in Syria, of course, all the equations have tumbled down and the situation is quite different. Why? I believe, in a sense, that most Christians, whether in Syria or across the whole MENA region, what they believe in is their citizenship rights, a kind of secular and democratic system of governance that would basically treat all citizens as equal. Now, that is not what is happening in any one of the Arab countries or the MENA region as a whole. However, you are right when you said, relatively speaking, they have been in some countries living a better life than in others. But these are because they are smaller communities that always congregate around power in order to protect themselves from the vagaries of the fact that their numbers are small. However, what we are seeing today is that increasing number of Christians Christians are fearful that this authoritative dictatorial system, the only alternative to it would be a more theocratic system, a less secular system, a more Islamist system. And therefore, what they're thinking of is, if given a choice between an authoritative dictatorial system or regime that they have had for the past four decades and a more Islamist, theocratic, religious system, they think that they might be safer with the former system rather than with the new one that is spawning in Egypt, in all other countries, even in Libya and other countries as we see in the MENA region. So they are, in a sense, caught between a rock and a hard place. However, this is not what all Christians are experiencing. There are some Christians who are very supportive of the regimes because they think that their future well-being relies on the survival of those regimes, whereas there are other Christians who are pretty much with the rights that those popular revolts are claiming, and they want to go for those citizens' rights. So there is a division there, and the Christians aren't being spared. Yesterday, only yesterday, James, I heard that the Syrian tanks had gone into the Armenian Christian quarter of Homs in Syria. Now, that in itself is telling as to the fact that the situation is not as black and white as we would like it to be, but there are very many gray shades in between. And of course, in Lebanon, and I take Lebanon as an example, where some of the Christians are supporting the popular revolts, and there are other political parties, Christian political parties, which are supporting the regime in the hope that the regime would actually protect them and let them be. I have a problem with that personally, because I think, as you yourself intimated in your question or observation to me, that we as Christians should go for peace, and we should also go for justice and for human dignity. That is very important, something that is transcendent to power, that is transcendent to consumerism, that is something that upholds and celebrates the dignity of the human being, any human being. And those regimes do not necessarily nurture the dignity of their citizens. They nurture their own power bases.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And let's be honest, we've seen how President al-Assad's regime has treated those it feels threatened by. If it felt threatened by the Christians, perhaps...
Then the Christians would also receive the same punitive action as anybody else. It's anybody who's not my friend is my enemy.
Yeah. Let's turn our attention to Libya. I always use the word stalemate, and I'm certainly not the only one. But, you know, there are hints now that the rebels are more organized and more able to sort of push towards Tripoli. In fact, not very far away now. Bring us up to speed on the situation there.
You're absolutely right, James. The situation in Libya had stalemated for a long while, and we were worried about how long this would carry on. Now, I think a combination of NATO bombings and attacks, coupled with the fact that the transitional council has become a little bit more of a coherent body that is able to direct the operations, plus the fact that there are serious divisions and a weakening of the Gaddafi regime, have meant that perhaps, but just perhaps, we are a little bit nearer to the end game. I think it's quite telling that the rebels, if I may use that term, although they wouldn't necessarily use it themselves, have actually control of three areas in West Libya, which basically controls all the entry points to Tripoli. They're controlling Gharian, they're controlling Zawiya, they're controlling Misrata, and today there are reports that they're also in control of Brega. Now, if they do that, it means that they actually stop any movement of arms coming in to help the Gaddafi regime. It means there is almost a pincer movement, and if they do not again retreat or lose those positions that they hold, then it is quite likely that the negotiations that are taking place discreetly nowadays would lead toward an end game. Now, what that end game would be, I cannot really foretell, and I'll throw at you my famous statement that I'm not a prophet. But there are many options. One is a negotiated deal whereby Gaddafi and his immediate family would be allowed to leave the country, perhaps go to Venezuela or somewhere in Africa or what have you. The other one is that if Gaddafi refuses to do that, and and he stays there, and he either gets captured or killed. The third one is that he unleashes all the arsenal that is still in his possession. For instance, he's got about 200, 300 Scud missiles. He's got some chemical weapons, not much, but he does have them. It depends how crazy is he going to be as his final stand, and whether he's going to opt for the scorched earth policy and say, basically, I'll burn everything before I lose the country, or whether he would actually relent and either leave or end his regime. So perhaps there is a slight hope there that things might quieten down. And of course, the departure one way or another of Gaddafi, if and when it happens, given that Tripoli is still his fiefdom, is not necessarily the end of the Libyan story, because then the more difficult, in my opinion, process starts of rebuilding the country with some people who don't have much experience of how to run a country.
We'll keep an eye on it, Harry, and perhaps in a couple of weeks we'll update on that one. Now, a place where, or certainly for a person, we see an end game of one sort or another, former President Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, on trial. I'm sure we've all seen those scenes of him in the hospital cot being wheeled in. You know, he faces the death penalty, Harry. Where's the trial at, and what's going on there with Egypt?
Well, I think, to be honest with you, that trial where, yes, the death penalty could be the ultimate sentence, but I don't think it will get to that. It will not get to that, first because reports confirm that he's seriously sick with cancer, and therefore there are even people who are speculating whether he would actually outlast the trial, which is not going to end in 2 or 3 days' time. So that's one option. The other option, perhaps life imprisonment, might be another sentence to consider. However, I would not look at it in that way. There are two things I see in this trial. The first is that it is cathartic. It is one way of expressing to the Egyptian people, all those people in Tahrir Square and elsewhere who fought against the regime, to say that here is the most visible, almost pharaonic symbol of authority for 3 decades, who is now so humble that he is brought into his cage in a court on a stretcher, and he's being tried. It's a way of giving people the opportunity to ventilate, and it's also a way for them to realize that indeed, in a country in the Arab world, Egypt, the biggest of them all, there is something called the rule of law and justice. So that is one thing that I think the authorities are hoping to do, and to encourage this political and social catharsis across this trial. The other thing, of course, that is also important, and some seasoned commentators have said this, James, is that we also should be a little bit careful that as we follow the trial of former President Mubarak, that we do not get too caught up in that moment, because Mubarak now represents the past. The future is ahead, and the future has to be constructed. And the best way to do it is to bring all the constituents of Egyptian society together in order to build a future, rather than be hung up on a man who has actually lost all power and looks pretty pathetic with his 2 sons in the cage. But what we already see are the ructions, the tiffs, the struggles for power between different constituencies of society on the issue of the parliamentary elections, on the issue of the presidential elections, on the issue of what does the constitution say or not say about those elections and about the way of governing Egypt, and also about how does Sharia law impact Christians. And there are about 10 million Christians in Egypt, original indigenous Coptic Christians, Catholic or Orthodox. How does it impact them? So for me, my hope is more to look toward the future, for Egypt to lead the way, rather than for me to keep looking at what happens to Mubarak. That's already a fallen icon in a country that is trying to stand up again.
Well, we sadly have to move on to Iraq. We haven't in recent times talked too much about Iraq.
We haven't,
but
indeed.
There have been a few church bombings there, Harry. So clearly targeting the Christian community. What's going on there?
Well, 2 things there about Iraq, James, very quickly, since we're doing a succinct analysis of the MENA region today. The first one is that if you consider that the invasion of Iraq took place a few years ago, and in those years, $30 trillion have been spent on trying to establish democracy in the country, I would hope that our own leaders in the West, and I include our own country, the United Kingdom, but also the European Union and America, to realize and to think a little bit more carefully in the future if we ever are in any economic position to embark on any other adventure. So I look at what is happening there, and then I look at the cuts that are happening right, left, and center, and somehow in my own simple mind, I do not see a kind of a balance between where we're spending our money and the big business and the big industries we're supporting, whilst the ordinary Joe Bloggs of this world and within the European Union are suffering. And we as Christians should also think of the marginalized, those who are poor, those who are powerless, rather than only think about those who have power and who are in control of things. That is my, let's say, my conceptual theory of where we are in Iraq. But in terms of the reality of what's happening on the ground, yes, the Christians are suffering. There are bombings, there are explosions in many churches. Recently, there were three, about 2 weeks ago, there was one against a Syrian Catholic church, and then there was one nearby against an evangelical Protestant church. And only a few days ago, St. Ephrem's Syrian Orthodox Church was also attacked, blown up, and one whole wall crumbled down. Now, there are attacks against the Christian communities in Kirkuk, that was, and in other parts of the country as well. But let us also take it in two ways. One, in the context of the larger attacks that are taking place in the country, which are trying to destabilize the country. And that destabilization is not only internal from within Iraq itself, but from its adjacent neighbors, each vying to have its own power play in the country itself, in Iraq, almost by proxy. So Muslims are suffering as much as Christians are. We, of course, look at the Christians because we as Christians have this sense of fellowship across the world with our sisters and brothers elsewhere, but also because their numbers are smaller and what happens to them impacts us directly. But this is something that everybody, Muslims and Christians, all minorities in fact, all smaller communities, are feeling the brunt of what's happening. The other thing I would say is that those attacks, if you've noticed when you said we haven't spoken about Iraq, they basically go into peaks and troughs. There are times when suddenly it's all quiet and they're basically trying to get on with a very difficult life. Second largest oil producing country doesn't have electricity half the time of the day in summer. Can you imagine that? I mean, somebody explain to me how this pans out. But the other thing is that there are external forces, be it Iran, be it Syria, be it other countries, that play a role in the instability that is taking place in Iraq. And a moot point I make, and it is a moot point because as a lawyer I would remind you that I don't have any evidence except circumstantial ones, that it is very interesting that at a time when the Syrian regime is trying to use every trick in the book to foment sectarian conflict, to try and prove that it alone can exercise order in the country and across the region, because Syria is viewed somehow as a regional power rather than just a local one, suddenly we have those explosions in bombs in Iraq. I just wonder what the connection is there, and I leave it to the imagination of our listeners to figure out what might or might not be the case.
Well, we've run out of time, Harry. We've really done our best to cover the bases there.
We've rushed today, haven't we?
We have. We've rocketed through it, but it's, you know, we've still spent a good 25 minutes chewing over
the
events in the
MENA region.
Well, I
think you and I have agreed, James, that our podcast would be more like analysis rather than news coverage. We don't have the resources for news coverage, but we basically just do a few points here and there to keep our listeners aware of what's happening to the Christian communities in the MENA region and to the larger geopolitical scene.
Well, we certainly have the resources to put your bottom on a seat to talk to us, Harry.
So thank you.
We thank you very much for that. That's Dr. Harry Hagopian, and you've been listening to another Middle East analysis.